Welcome, everyone, as always, to our January 2026 FOMC panel of experts. Now, today, we've got a ton of topics. I know I say that for every single one, but today it's starting to feel like maybe a little bit more than usual. The economy keeps throwing mixed signals. Growth is still holding up, but confidence seems to be fading a bit. Housing affordability remains tight, and markets can't really seem to agree on what the Fed's next move should be. We've also got trade tensions back in the headlines. Safe haven assets like gold and silver are ripping to significant all-time highs, seemingly every day at this point. In tandem with that, equities are kind of doing the same. I know we got a little bit of up and down today, but they do seem to be moving in tandem, which we'll talk more about later. On top of that, policy pressure is rising and data has been sending some conflicting messages, and there's plenty for the Fed to handle today. So let's jump in to a couple of our introductions for those we've got so far. Starting off, as always, we're excited to welcome back Joseph Wayne, better known to most of you as the Fed guy. Joseph previously ran trading on the Fed's open markets desk, literally working inside the machine, and he's now the CIO at Monetary Macro. He's also the author of Central Banking 101, which somehow manages to make this Fed understandable. Joseph, great to have you back as always, man. How you doing?
And thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here. It's great to be with my friends on the panel again. So I'm looking forward to a great discussion.
As am I. Thanks for coming, Joseph. Up next, we've got another frequent flyer on the Unusual Whales Air, the last bear standing, focusing heavily on markets and monetary policy, and puts out some great weekly analysis on his Substack. If you're not already subscribed to that, that's your homework after the panel. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. Looking forward to the first FOMC of 2026. So thanks always for having me on the panel. Looking forward to the discussion.
And thanks as always for coming, man. Love getting your input on a lot of these topics. Next, we've got Martin Peltier. Martin is a portfolio manager at Trivest Wealth Council, a regular contributor to mediums like the Financial Post, and possibly the only person on this panel who can talk macro all day, every day, and still wake up early to cut up the slopes the next morning. Good to have you back, Martin.
Hey, thanks for having me. Excited to talk about this new world order and our Governor Carney.
I'm excited to get some of that international take from up north too, man. I'm sure you've got a lot to say. And rounding things out, folks, we're welcoming back Johnny Matthews of Super Macro. He's spent over two decades trading and investing with a strong macro focus, and today he runs Super Macro, where he breaks down global markets and economic trends in real time. Always great to have you here, Johnny. Welcome back.
Thank you, Nicholas. It's great to be back on the show, especially with such a distinguished panel. Thank you.
And as everybody knows, the distinguished panelist he's referring to most is, of course, me. I'm brilliant macro mind, and there's no sarcasm in this statement whatsoever. So I'm going to jump right in here. We might be joined later by Jem Carson. We'll see what his availability is like. But to start us off, heading into the FOMC meeting, markets continue to kind of swing between pricing one or multiple rate cuts this year, while Fed officials have reiterated patience and data dependence following the December meeting. Now, with futures pricing continuing to move more aggressively, arguably, than the Fed's most recent projections, what should investors be paying more attention to right now? The Fed's guidance at face value, or kind of the market's expectations so far? Joseph, can you start us off?
So I think the market's in a tough spot right now. So when the market prices the expected path of Fed policy, it's trying to anticipate what the data will be and also how the Fed will react to it. But we're kind of in this weird position where we're going to have a new Fed chair, and maybe Jay Powell will step down and Trump will get another appointee. So that Fed reaction function of this is really unknown. And so I think the market has a lot of difficulty trying to figure out just what this new Fed will look like and what its reaction will be. So whatever it's priced in the market, I think it's inaccurate. And there's really no way to know until we have more clarity to this. What we do know, of course, is that anyone who becomes Fed chair has to assure the president that he's going to go for a lot of cuts. You know, the president was murmuring 1%. Probably something more reasonable would be what Governor Myron has suggested, maybe 3 or 4 cuts up to 2.5%. So I think right now the market just doesn't really know how to understand what this new Fed will look like.
Well, kind of on that note, projections for today sit pretty firmly low for there to be any cuts. It's a pretty firm hold projection from like CME Fed Watch. Discussed that a little bit on our morning show this morning. And now, that said,
I'm sorry about it. Of course, there's nothing happening. I'm talking about the rest of the year. Apologies. You're totally right. There's basically no chance that we do anything today.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I just kind of want to like juxtapose that a little bit. Inflation having cooled meaningfully from its peak, that real policy rate, again, kind of remaining firmly positive. Is there a point where holding rates at their current levels becomes an active drag on growth? Or are we just seeing, you know, like I said earlier, that tentative wait for data to come? Last bear, do you want to tickle that one quick? And then I kind of want to kick it around the panel to see how everybody's feeling about today specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I personally don't think that there's a lot of evidence for the sense that, you know, interest rates are a huge drag on the economy or will start to become one. If anything, we've seen tightening spreads, for example, in corporate debt issuances, as well as mortgages, which obviously maybe the mortgage aspect is probably even more important. I think one of the biggest areas where we saw rate hikes in prior years impact the real economy was in the housing market, obviously. And so the fact that, you know, mortgage rates have continued to compress, both due to sort of the base rate coming down as well as sort of compression of the sort of mortgage spread on top of that, really seems to be, I mean, I wouldn't say that the housing market is in a fantastic position, but it doesn't seem to be deteriorating. And I think more recent data seems to show that those mortgage rates are having sort of a positive effect on at least stabilizing, maybe in some places improving the housing market. And I think that's definitely the segment that's, you know, most probably rate sensitive, and that you could argue has been a drag so far. I don't think that there's really much evidence in financial markets, for example, that, you know, that current rates, especially given that they've realized rates or effective rates continue to come down and have been declining for several years, you know, is having a drag on capital markets activity. If anything, I think we see, obviously, the, you know, stock market continue to perform quite well. And even things like, you know, capital market activity, IPOs and follow-ons and sort of all that sort of continue to heat up both last year and I think going into this year with the potential for, you know, some blockbuster IPOs and that sort of stuff. It doesn't feel like an environment that's particularly constrained by rates today. Obviously, the administration wants to, you know, turbocharge things by continuing to sort of lower that barrier. But I don't think that there's a real case for that being a significant hindrance today. And I think that what the Fed is sort of, you know, balancing now is the reality that they already have eased, you know, somewhat substantially over the past 2 to 3 years. You know, growth continues to sort of look pretty solid, you know, they're balancing obviously what's the appropriate sort of rate going forward and making sure that they're not sort of feeding into. So it looks like you know, the Fed is taking a more balanced approach, but whether that can survive sort of political pressure, I guess we'll see.
Well, I think fundamentals is a increasingly confusing word. We have incredibly opaque data reporting. You know, can't trust the numbers. Two, we have a administration that is doing, you know, that is, you know, we have a bifurcated set of conversations about policy going on, right? We have what the Fed's saying, and then we have what the administration is saying. And as we know, the administration's about to announce a shadow Fed. So we're going to have two very different, you know, Fed chairs essentially speaking at the same time for the next 6 to 5 months. So my point is, it's uncertainty. It's not really about inflation or GDP growth nearly as much at this point, as it is about broad uncertainty about policy. And then you layer in not just who's deciding what policy and what does that mean, and what are the actual numbers to begin with, which are increased uncertainty enough as it is. But then you bring in the, just the broader uncertainty of a, as we've highlighted before, about a fiscal dominant populist environment where, you know, spending is not monetary policy driven. You know, we're moving, transitioning from a supply side economic model to a demand side model, which, as Arthur Burns, you know, laid out, I encourage people who haven't read any of his, you know, the Fed chair from the 70s under Nixon, read any of his papers, but the, you know, as he's documented during times of fiscal spending and government increased involvement, it's incredibly difficult for a Federal Reserve to deal with their dual mandate. And so there's, this is not the last 40 years of Federal Reserve policy where it was based on cyclical, are we entering a period of cyclical growth or a period of cyclical slowdown? There are structural inflationary pressures, and imbalancing those is increasingly difficult in a political environment. So coming into the midterms, last of all, not only is this a structurally difficult period, and there's increasing uncertainty and opacity and different players, but you're dealing with an administration that that broke that fiscal dominance, populist kind of call it, you know, 8-year movement to go against political, you know, their populist rhetoric to do very supply side economic model at the beginning of the year as well. And now are being forced kicking and screaming to, much like Nixon was, to do much more fiscally dominant policy all of a sudden again. And that creates a dramatic whipsaw effect, a dramatic amount of uncertainty. So if you're wondering what's driving kind of volatility and uncertainty, it is not the two-dimensional, is it inflation or is it growth that we've talked about for 40 years. It really is a different regime, a different set of players, opacity of data, and opacity of who's doing what, and these are big questions with dramatic consequences.
Thank you, Jim. To just kind of piggyback off of that a little bit, Johnny, from your point of view as well, how do you feel about that notion that shifting from supply side to demand side and kind of the connotations therein?
Well, first of all, I do want to just make one point that volatility is really, really low. You know, if you look at Treasury vol, it's close to a 3 or 4 year low at the moment. So rates volatility hasn't really picked up as a result of this uncertainty. And just to address the increasing risk of fiscal dominance that we've been discussing up to now, one of the things I'm really less sure about is just how dovish and compliant this new Fed will be. We have four new regional Fed presidents rotating on for this meeting. Two of them are outright hawks. You know, Beth Hammack and Lori Logan are notable hawks. Anna Paulson is a dove, we know that. Neil Kashkari, he flips between being hawkish and dovish. He's quite pragmatic. Then we look at the governors, and at the moment, you know, there is this suspicion that Christopher Waller, you know, he really wants the Fed chair job, but I do think he is also very objective in his views of where policy should be. And I don't think he is the kind of person who would act to curry favor with the president. Let's put it this way. He, about a month or two ago, he was on TV making a quite a robust defense of Fed independence. He said he's got he spent 20 years of his life working on central bank independence, and there's a long paper trail of this. So, you know, this idea that the Fed is just going to suddenly become compliant to the president's wishes, I'm not so sure about that. Even if Rick Reeder becomes the chairman, you know, it sure, he's an outright bull, but he does know a thing or two about fixed income markets, and he's going to make sure that the long end doesn't get completely trashed by investor fears that the Fed is going to be super dovish in the face of a fairly, what looks to be a fairly healthy economy. So I think, as just getting back to what Joseph said, at the moment, we are very, very uncertain to what the reaction function of the Fed will be. But I'm more of the view that I don't think this the new Fed will be quite as dovish as perhaps the market expects.
Now, just kind of back on this, you know, financial conditions in general, kind of they've repeatedly loosened and tightened over recent months, and markets kind of oscillate between optimism around rate cuts, then concern over lingering inflation. A lot of stuff just seems to be really momentum based and people piling in. But when equity rallies ease financial conditions ahead of actual policy change, I wonder if that at all undermines the Fed's effort to keep policy restrictive. Martin, I'd love your take there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors that would want to the Fed would want to consider in regards to being restrictive. Equity markets and the amount of liquidity driving those equity markets certainly is one of them. Trump, I mean, back things up a little bit. Politics drives policy. Let's just not kid ourselves. In Canada, looking at what the speech Carney did in Davos, that was very much politically driven. He's only a couple of seats short of a majority, and playing Canadians up against American policy works very well in his favor. In regards to the U.S., again, politics drives policy. You have midterms coming up, and you need policy that's going to support the administration that has fallen out of support by the general population. And that is easing, and that's the housing market, and that's why they're putting a lot of pressure, in my opinion, on interest rates. And the housing market is a core component of Main Street and of the voters. It certainly is in Canada due to the demographic profile and the control they own over the votes. If you look at housing, it's gone no bid, and home sales are the lowest level since 1995, and mortgage rates are still high. And so they're, you know, they'd like to see, you know, some support there. Gasoline prices are certainly very much helping the Main Street, but not, it needs more than that. So I think that the U.S. dollar is something that we haven't talked about yet, but I think it's a way of the Trump administration, you know, getting some stimulus by cutting rates, by letting the dollar slide. You know, it's reducing the debt servicing costs, it's stimulating exports, and it's accomplishing what he wants to, or what they want to achieve politically ahead of, but that's creating all kinds of instabilities everywhere. In Europe, for example, with the euro being near its highs, especially against China, that's pegged to the dollar. You have the Canadian dollar, that's still very support, still okay. And the Bank of Canada keeping rates flat recently today, and then the bond markets and in the metals market as well too, and so that political narrative driving policy is having a global influence and a whole bunch of unintended consequences that I'm, you know, very curious to see how it's going to play out.
Yeah, I think. Just to jump in here real quick, to answer, you know, I think there's two issues being discussed here and they're related. But one, 100%, I want to make sure everybody understands that Fed policy is a far, far second, as big and important as the Fed is, far second to market outcomes. You know, there's $500 trillion of long assets in this world. Include stocks, bonds, private equity, private credit, real estate, right? $500 trillion. If we get a 10% appreciation in markets and assets, that's a $50 trillion collateral increase. People don't think about it that way, but the dominant force of given the financialization and leverage of markets is the market itself. It's not even close. And so, you know, to look at Federal Reserve policy in a vacuum, how much QE are they doing? How much, what are they lowering interest rates? And how much does that affect things is to miss, you know, how much liquidity does that increase is to miss the big picture, is that the primary driver of liquidity by far is markets themselves. So the most powerful force that the Federal Reserve has, as well as, by the way, the Oval Office, is, you know, used to be called the bully pulpit. The reality is if the Fed speaks and it projects market moves, the move that happens in the markets is actually the driver of liquidity, and it's dramatically bigger. So the problem becomes when the Fed or administration begins to lose their ability to project market moves with their narrative. And we've seen that happened last year. They gained a bit more control, partially because they did dramatic supply side responses. But that's really the big question. So, you know, to the extent is, does the narrative and does the market move pull forward or affect, you know, the outcomes of the Fed and the administration? 100%. That's the whole story. The market is the story. You know, the entities that are loosely being able to navigate and push the markets around is what we focus on. But they have a tenuous, you know, often dominant, but at times they lose control. And when they lose control, that's when problems begin. And so we've seen this time and time again the last several years. You know, markets are weak, so they, you know, or they want to project some economic strength, so they project out on the dot plots and in commentary, and then, you know, a cut, and then all of a sudden inflation picks up and growth picks up before they actually do anything. And that's really the critical point. So that's the answer to that question. But I agreed with Martin as well, this is a separate topic, that they're increasingly put in a box because of the political, you know, politics is the story. Populism, by definition, is political. And this is why election cycles matter so much during these populist cycles. This is why, you know, we had a very different administration in year one, you know, because of they had a mandate, they had the ability to go against the populist kind of policies and to try and push a much more capital friendly, business friendly approach in a populist kind of environment. And I said at the time, there's a lot of exuberance in December 24, January of 25. About the change that was coming, guess what? We're amidst a dramatic populist wave, resurgence, fiscal policy coming online, and you know, whether it's 10% caps on credit cards, or it's checks to military families, or, you know, go all the way down the line, the policies coming through are incredible. Like amounts to, you know, capital controls, and this is very similar to Nixon. I mean, Nixon rolled back the Great Society program. Opened up China, did a dramatic amount of supply side economics as soon as he came into office, and was forced, kicking and screaming due to politics, by his midterms a year and change later, to institute price controls. And I think this is a very similar, again, we talked about it here live just over a year ago. You know, this is back on track with the bigger multi-decade trend. And really, the last year was a bit of an aberration. And the fact that the world is now looking and assuming what happened last year is, which is an attempt to get back to the 40-year trend, is reality, I think, is missing the big picture, is that politics is on a head, you know, crash course with monetary policy, and that's going to drive some really difficult outcomes for the Federal Reserve.
And I'll just add what's going to be curious. Markets are, as we all know, are forward-looking, and when do they start? You know, are they ignoring the existing Fed and looking past to the new one? And are they looking towards, you know, what the government's going to look like in following midterms? When does that happen? And then how is the impact going to be on the markets? Because it did so in April. It was able to correct last year, correctly anticipate in regards to the lack of impact of tariffs on the consumer. Everyone's worried about that. that have been followed in other areas that I had just mentioned previously. But overall, I mean, we're probably going to see these markets, these equity markets, change in the next month or so or 2 months, because it's looking past what we're seeing right now. So the big question is today, is it really that relevant? Today's FOMC, is it really that relevant considering what, you know, I just highlighted?
Can I just make a couple of points here?
Please do, yeah.
Yeah. First of all, you know, in the past when the Fed got really, really proactive, one of the arguments was that financial conditions have tightened. And what they meant was that, you know, equities were on their ass and credit spreads were blowing out and things were going kind of haywire. And that was an excuse for easing or stepping up the quantitative easing, whatever they were doing, really going guns blazing to support the markets. That is not the case now. Market, as I'm not sure who it was, whether it was Martin or Jim, one of the speakers previously said credit spreads are incredibly tight. Whether it's you know, investment grade or junk credit, spreads are incredibly tight. If we also look at the Fed, the funds rate right now, you know, inflation is close to 3%. We've got a funds rate of 3.625. I mean, a 1% funds rate was typically real rate was typically considered neutral. We're down at close to 0.5%. So it's very difficult to say in any respect that conditions are tight. And when we look at the labor market, Powell himself said that because we have, you know, currently net migration has fallen close to zero, it could even be negative now. The supply of labor is much reduced. The break-even level of job creation that we need to keep the unemployment rate stable is probably, Powell said, between 0 and 60,000. I think it was the Dallas Fed did a study recently where they came up with a figure of 30,000 a month. That's all the job creation you need to keep the unemployment rate stable. So I just think it's very difficult to make a strong case for easing at the present time. That's not to say the administration won't be piling pressure on the Fed to ease, to just keep the show on the road. But I think for a lot of these Fed governors and Fed and voting FOMC members, I'm not sure they see the need. I know others on this panel may disagree with me.
I think that what Johnny is saying is absolutely right, and that's what's in the market pricing, right? The market agrees with Johnny. It's not really pricing nearly as many cuts as you would say, listening to the president's rhetoric. But I'll make the case of why the argument would be for more cuts, and that's what I mean. The people who are more dovish, they're not saying that I'm going to do this because I'm under political pressure. What they will tell you is two things. One is that they'll tell you that the labor market is weakening, and if you look at a trend of the unemployment rate, it's definitely trending higher. And if you look at the earnings reports from companies, they'll tell you the same thing. We're not really hiring. When I was reading the transcripts from the big bank earnings, what surprised me is that if they're all, you know, saying that, well, next year is going to be better, but by the way, we're cutting some people. And you also have news today that Amazon is cutting people. So it seems like in some industries, this AI thing really is weakening demand for labor, and that's going to push up the unemployment rate. Now, the second thing that I think it's more of a new thing that all the wannabe Fed chairs are arguing for is productivity boom. And I have to credit Johnny with this, because last year I was quite bearish on the economy, thinking that, you know, we're not having job growth, so obviously we can't have good GDP growth. But Johnny rightly noted on this discussion last year that we could have a huge productivity boom. And that seems to be what happened now. And if you look at the FOMC dot plots, they're all revising up their GDPs, and they're not really doing much with their employment. So that the implication is a productivity boom. Some would say, like you saw during the tech boom. And so if that's the case, you know, that's downward pressure on inflation as well. That's coming down the train. So you should follow Greenspan and so forth, and not be hiking into this, or we should be cutting. So I think that's the standard argument that's put forth by the more dovish members of the FOMC.
Thank you, Joseph. And I love the callback there to Johnny too, because I really like having all the context that all the panelists have. And I just want to touch a little bit there, just to kind of, you know, skim the surface of the labor market, because I do have some other questions about employment dynamics as well. But just kind of off the top, since we brought it up a few times now, Nick Timmerhouse over at Wall Street Journal actually described the labor market pretty similar to that. He called it a no hire, no fire equilibrium. And so I guess my question here is, as you guys just noted, you know, it's a kind of unemployment's kind of stemming a little bit more, it seems, from hiring simply disappearing rather than layoffs. Even though some layoffs are happening, it doesn't seem extremely severe on the surface. And so I wonder, is that a dangerous equilibrium to be in, where that labor market unemployment rises not from layoffs, but simply from hiring disappearing? Les Baer, do you have anything to kind of tickle that topic with?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are elements that help explain sort of the current dynamic. Obviously, the first one that always needs to be mentioned is that, you know, the weakening in the labor market from the past 2, 3, 4 years came from probably one of the tightest labor markets, arguably, that, you know, that we've ever had, at least in modern memory. And so there's some amount of just like normalization happening. At the same time, a huge sort of supply issue, you know, with respect to the level of immigration. If you look at the you know, the job growth in let's say 2023 and 2024, basically perfectly matched what was estimated to be sort of the net immigration in the country, whereas now, you know, that's come basically to a halt. And at the same time, we see job growth come to a halt, but, you know, the unemployment rate, even if it's ticked up a little bit, has kind of stayed relatively flattish for some time. So I do think that there are a lot of balancing factors that make it hard to sort of see through to, you know, basically this cycle looks very different than what, you know, you would traditionally have in many of the past economic cycles, where you have sort of a peak in labor market dynamics that sort of rolls over and then sort of accelerates to the downside in some sort of, you know, recession or depression, and then sort of, you know, find a bottom and come back out. I think that we're just in a very different cycle, both respect to, you know, the past unusual decade, as well as, you know, things like the fiscal spending that we're sort of continuing at a level, you know, we're at 6% gap in terms of the deficit as a percentage of GDP. I mean, that used to be reserved for, you know, deep depressions. And now that's just sort of the status, you know, the status quo in good times. And there's, you know, structural factors to that make it almost impossible to reverse that, even if we, you know, do DOGE and go after fraud. You know, they're just not going to make a significant dent. I mean, tariffs to one extent, I think, you know, to Trump's credit, the tariffs have brought in actually a pretty significant amount of money, something like $360 billion a year, which, you know, which is meaningful in the scheme of things. But overall, we have this fiscal impulse that's just continues to pump money, continues to sort of, you know, continue to juice the economy. And I think that's an element that also sort of like plays into this, where you have circulation of money that isn't necessarily totally hinged on employment. So I think that it's, you know, what we've seen basically is for the past year, job growth basically stall out, and yet that doesn't seem to impact spending or GDP. And I think it's just, you know, we have to be careful about making extrapolations based on historical precedents that just don't really apply.
Martin, I see your hand there. Go ahead, man.
Yeah. Okay. So we're in a really unique situation right now. If you look at Social Security outlays, given the aging demographic in the U.S., and you put that combined with interest payments on the federal debt, it now matches the entire federal revenue base. So you have three options you got to face. You have to grow your way out of it, which is the ideal situation. That's not happening. I mean, GDP numbers are good. They're okay. I think Goldman Sachs was saying like 2 to 2.5% this year. And so it's okay. It's chugging along. That's not going to grow your way out of this. One is, number two is, you cut your spending, and that is not going to happen. You know, that voter base, as I mentioned earlier, age driven or the demographics are going to keep you in office or vote you out. Or three, debasement. That's what we're happening. That's what I see right now. So and that debasement, the big question is it helping those looking for work or hurting them, right? And those who are looking for work probably don't have a lot of assets to hedge themselves against that. And so I'm of the position that you should be cutting spending rather than interest rates. And that will help the job market and those looking for work, those who don't own as much assets, more so than cutting rates and inflating those assets. I know that's a pretty radical statement, but you know, gold going to $5,500 is telling you something there.
Yeah, we'll definitely double back to gold because I have a lot on that. But first, I wanted to touch on what you just said there, like the job hunt struggle. CNN actually reported that in December of last year, the probabilities of finding a job hit a record low of 43.1%. And so I guess I kind of wonder, even though job openings remain elevated, I can't remember what percentage it was, but it was reported that a good chunk of those weren't even really being offered. And so I wonder if that, compounded with, you know, that probability of 43% of even finding a job that CNN reported, does that suggest labor demand is actually overstated, or are firms just becoming unusually cautious?
Well, maybe there's a shift in the type of demand that's happening. Like, if you look at young people, I mean, this is why we're seeing changes. Like in New York, you're told in the old days, you go to university and you know, you get out of school and you're going to get a job and your life's, you're going to be able to buy a house. And now you go to school, 1 in 4 graduates from university are not finding work. That's insane. And then you got to leverage up at 10 times your income to buy a house at a 6% mortgage rate. Again, another problem. So is it systemic, or is it the type of work that is in demand right now? And is there a mismatch, or is there some bigger issues?
And we can't talk about, sorry.
I have a business idea, guys. How about we create a university for podcasting and for newsletters?
Hey, I'm in. Let's go.
But I mean, this is the root of the problem, right? Like everybody can, we can talk in platitudes and talk about like, this is what the, is ideal for policy. We need to reduce spending. Right. But how do you, in a world where we've sent money to capital and, you know, to what I call Planet Palo Alto, right, for 40 years, and driven a supply side boom of technology that obviates the need for humans? We globalize, you know, these corporations have taken, you know, this is their incentive. I'm not saying they did anything wrong, right? But they've gone to the lowest labor place they can to and reduce the need for, you know, Western labor. As those voters who have been labor since they left college in 1990s or early 2000s, and even now, how are you buying a home? How are you paying off your debt from college? How are you, you know, starting a family?
50-year mortgages, baby.
And so, you know, at some point, you can't just keep doing the same thing. These are not cogs in a wheel. Cogs in a wheel would, you know, the answer is very clear. Just keep pumping more oxygen, more money into the air and let evolutionary capital forces take over and build more technologies and create advancement and growth. But there are, these cogs are human beings, and there's a fairness issue that politically is, you cannot avoid. And we created the Federal Reserve to smooth the business cycle. Everybody loves that idea. That sounds great. But the problem is we gave them one tool, which is monetary policy, which is sending money to corporations or not sending money to corporations. There are no people involved. And we gave them two mandates, which is price stability and essentially GDP maximization. We call it, you know, maximizing unemployment. But, you know, I'm not sure that that's 100% true either. And at the end of the day, you know, you give any machine those incentives, and this is what you get. You get dramatic inequality, and with, you know, everything, if you're a hammer, everything you see is a nail. And so we put the Fed in charge of the whole economy.
And the Fed has no mandate to deal with equality. So at some point, the release valve in a democracy is government has the power of the purse, and government has to step in. And when the second government does, the monetary policy machine short circuits. That's where we are. That's what's happening. Yeah, we should decrease spending. That makes sense for optimal, efficient outcomes. But what about the equality question? And that's where we are. That's the big picture. We've talked about it out here for years. And they can try and go back and do the same levers. But what about fairness? What about equality? And the AI technological boom is only making it worse. Okay, so there's only really one way out. We can avoid that outcome for a year or two in a political cycle, but that's really the big question.
I'll add on to Jim's point that, you know, you think back to how central bank policy was for the past 20 years, right? After the great financial crises, there was kind of an austerity movement throughout the world. And so if you are a central bank with an inflation mandate, or if you're in the US with an inflation and employment mandate, you know, that austerity movement really doesn't help your goal. And you're kind of, you just have this one tool and you're trying to achieve this really big goal. So as the fiscal authorities step back, you have the central banker step in to fill that void. And the solution that Bernanke came up with was just the wealth effect, right? You pump assets up really high, that improves spending, and that helps the economy. And, you know, that seems to have morphed into what we have today. Everyone says it's kind of a, you know, kind of a K-shaped economy where you have people with assets doing really well. Now, on the aggregate, that looks like it works, right? Because that's keeping unemployment low, because these really wealthy people who still have assets, who have been inflated in part due to monetary policy, that's fine. And if you're a central bank, you're targeting aggregate numbers. And so it, on the surface, it looks like you're meeting your goal, but you have these huge distributional frictions where a lot of people are basically have no hope of ever buying a home or ever gradually advancing. So these frictions are becoming increasingly important, as Jim notes. So this is in part due to design, and probably why, a big reason why, that there is more and more question as to what role a central bank should play and how much say the executive or the legislator will have in how a central bank behaves.
A few points. I mean, it's a very difficult situation for the central bank. Earlier on, we heard the argument for lowering rates so that people could perhaps get lower cost mortgages and help things along that way. But if you somehow successfully lower the mortgage rate, then it will just boost the price of houses. You know, it's very, very difficult. In the UK, we had a help to buy scheme where first time buyers were given some sort of benefit to help them get on the housing ladder, but it just pushed up the price of houses. So there is no easy solution to this. And one of the other points that I wanted to make, just getting back to this business of that K-shaped recovery, the Fed regularly does a consumer household survey where they look at the spending by wealth or income decile. And you know, there's this popular idea that the top 10% are responsible for 50% of the consumer spending going on at the moment. That's not borne out by the Fed study. The Fed study shows that I think you have to go to the top 30% of income, the top three income deciles, to get to 50% of total consumption spending. And also, if you look through history, if you look at the how this has changed over time, it hasn't changed that much. I don't think the Gini coefficient of the US is getting any higher. If it has, it's moved up marginally. But there is this common perception that, you know, the lower classes are being left behind. I just think the US has always been a very capitalistic society. It has been like this always. And the idea of trying to normalize things and to make things much more even is very, very difficult to do. It just is really, really difficult. But That said, if you look at the billionaires that are around today, the tech billionaires, they came from most of them came from very modest incomes to start with, fairly modest income households. So that is the thing. There is this wealth mobility. There is this, you can start off relatively on modest means in the US and become very, very successful. And that's not necessarily the case in other countries. So, you know, the US is doing some things right.
Thank you, Johnny. One thing I wanted to harp on really quick, just kind of like a slight mention earlier, but just one more thing on the labor market. Wage growth itself has stayed pretty stagnant, moderated from pandemic era highs, but it is still above the pre-2020 norms, especially in like service sector jobs. And I wonder, and last bear, I'll pick your brain on this one. How much further cooling would the Fed really need to see before feeling comfortable that wage-driven inflation risks are actually contained?
I think like where things are now, I mean, you mentioned, I think that, wage growth has been, maybe it's a little bit higher than the prior decade, but it's been pretty stable for the past year or two. And at the same time, other metrics within the labor market don't necessarily scream wage price spiral. So I don't think that is going to be a key concern, at least at this point. The other thing just to mention on prices and that side of the mandate, I know people have various opinions of trueflation, but it has been interesting to watch, that metric sort of really take a dive in the past couple months or past couple weeks, which we'll see if that comes through in official data. That can be a lot noisier than the official data. But I do, it will be interesting to see, if we see inflation tick down in official gauges. I think that gives the Fed a whole lot more room to feel more aggressive on the, on the policy perspective. But I do agree, I think that at the same time, people have talked about the wealth effect and the K-shaped recovery and the 1%, all that kind of stuff. I do think that at the same time as all that happens, what you are going to see is policy changes sort of driven by anger in this in this dynamic. And I think that whether it's populism on the right or left, I think that increasingly you're going to see candidates that are coming forward with what previously might be considered kind of radical or fringe ideas being embraced by a whole lot more people than maybe was the case, especially among younger people. And so whether by if you're going to set up an economic system that sort of perpetuates this discrepancy, at some point there's going to be potentially policy action that tries to rectify that. Now, whether that'll be successful or not, we'll see. But I do think that that's something that we shouldn't be surprised to see policy measures that before wouldn't have much traction at all continue to gain traction, especially amongst younger people.
Thank you, Last Bear. So I'm going to pivot here 10 minutes before we get some data dropped on us and touch a little bit more on equities and gold. Now, Reuters commented when gold hit 5,000, which as we've seen quite clearly now, has hit the rearview mirror pretty handedly as of yesterday even. And then obviously overnight, we saw quite a rally up from there as well. And a lot have said that the rally itself has been driven by a falling dollar, geopolitical risk, renewed trade tensions, worries about Fed independence, persistent safe haven demand. Given this backdrop, though, what exactly does gold's ascent into these consecutive all-time highs really imply about market confidence in the U.S. dollar, especially given that equities have been rising kind of right alongside with it? Now, Jem, I know at least a year ago, man, on this very show, you mentioned the potential for blow-off tops in things like gold and silver. Kind of seems like that's going on. So I would like your take here. What are we looking at with everything moving up together?
In 2020, early 22, we were very clear when gold was floundering near lows and everybody, nobody was thinking about the structural inflation that gold would be the best performing asset for the next 10, 20 years. So buy it with leaps, do it with leverage. Gold call was also incredibly low. Importantly, it wasn't just a directional call. 60s and 70s, gold was the best performing asset by far. And it was also the most volatile asset. You had a chance to take advantage of both of those trends with leverage. That has been a trade that has made your career if you were in it for the last 3 years. It is not over. This is another 10 to 15 year trade. That said, it is going to be much more volatile. I mean, it's been not volatile to the upside. It will be a two-sided trade. It is not going to go in a straight line forever to the middle. We have yet to see any meaningful breaks. In the first early stages, this is what happens. It's a sharp, steep run, and then speculation comes in, and you have fundamental buyers, and you have speculative buyers. And so the word is out. Everybody sees what's happening. It's becoming everybody I talk to is now asking me about getting into gold or silver or platinum. Yeah. Everybody that wasn't talking about it 3 years ago. So the answer is these things don't go in a straight line. We will get something ugly that will wash out a lot of the speculative longs, but the trend is higher. This is why implied volatility, despite dramatically increasing in calls over all this time, is still the right way to play it. But if you're still just YOLOing from 3 years ago, or in particularly if you're in the underlying asset or Delta One kind of stuff, it's the out of the money calls that are going to make this work for you and to manage the risk on these positions. Volatility is your friend. It is expensive. I hear you. And there are ways to take advantage of that. But I would say this is a very important time for precious metals. And it is a bit of an inflection point, given the coming transition in the Federal Reserve, given the move, the whipsaw I already highlighted, just one of the most important things that people can be focused on right now. Last year saw a lot of tremendous trends, that are the 40-year trend that we've, in my opinion, are moving away from into a regime change, reignite briefly. And again, that was because of an administration that came back in and tried to move away from a lot of the 4+ years of strong fiscal dominance, and they're being forced kicking and screaming back into bigger regime change trend. And so I think it's an incredibly important time to see what's happening. And to realize that the last year or so, what I don't think will happen is in 22, everybody who was a RIA or advisor who had a precious metals allocation got bailed out from the correlation breakdown of bonds and equities. Given how crowded that is, the RIA space, how many people have used precious metals now as their diversifier, their tail, looking back at what happened in 22? It will, if equities decline with equities this time around, and will not be a safe haven, in my opinion, in the next pullback. But the secular trend is still alive and will be, and you will see another dramatic rally after a bit of a washout. So that would be my view broadly on where we are. Timing is tough, but I do think at this point, early in the year, given what we've seen, it's a good time to be thinking about things in that way.
And I do think that maybe Joseph might kind of be inclined to agree with that a little bit, because I saw your post, Joseph, that you offloaded both your paper silver and your giant silver hammer. What do you think? Is the high Zen for now?
Yeah, that post went out a bit viral. When just looking at silver, it looks like there's a lot of momentum in that. And what I've observed is that over the past few years, you kind of have a character change in who participates in the market. You have a lot of people who go and, just kind of lever up and just rush into and chase momentum. You saw that with NFTs, with meme coins, with crypto and so forth. And you see it in a lot of sectors in the US equity markets too, like uranium and so forth, and sometimes in some tech stocks. So I got the sense that, they are in precious metals now. And I think the secular trend in gold is continues to be higher. But then when you have this kind of volatility, and if you look at a price chart of silver over the past few decades, periodically it goes to this moon and then it just kind of implodes. And silver in particular, I think it's a bit different from gold in that it's actually an industrial metal. And so when you have a lot of speculators pumping it up, that impacts the interests of, say, industrial policy, maybe national security. And so that's something that impacts people who have strong interests. And so when we saw what happened with the Hunt brothers in the 80s when they squeezed it, you know, the powers that be kind of step in and they, you know, they can basically rig the game so that makes it go down. So I don't have that same concern with gold, which I think really is something that's going to be, like Jen mentioned, in a secular uptrend. One of the interesting things I've observed is that, so when we have this sell America trade because of geopolitical risk that emanates from the US, you know, everything gets sold except gold. You saw that in April last year as well. So I think that that is going to play a more useful, I think there's more awareness that can play a useful role as a portfolio diversificator.
Thank you, Joseph. Martin, I saw that you raised your hand earlier. Did you have some points to make on what Jem and Joseph were saying?
Yeah, it's pretty important. I posted a chart on the chat. You know, equities versus gold are when measured gold, are 12-year low. You want to look at what's going to be your debasement hedge and what's going to protect you the most. And it's certainly not going to be housing anymore. I think that trade has sailed. Equities, yeah, you know, it's okay. Bitcoin, certainly not the case. And in talking with here in Canada, we're so stubborn with the 60-40, you know, bullshit, I'll say it, because this is the way it's been, and it's always going to be this way. Well, there's a fundamental shift in 2022. And if you're not paying attention to what's happening globally in Japan, for example, or other areas, and the shift, you got to sell something to buy something. And, you know, if they're selling treasuries, they're buying gold, with the exception of Canada, because we don't own any gold. It's kind of funny that way. So having some in your portfolio is a necessity, even with the rally over 5,000. If you don't have at least a couple percent of gold in your portfolio, you're not doing it. And I've got I'm managing large portfolios. I have to have that in my portfolio to protect against debasement. If you look at your dollar, the value of your dollar is 74 cents in the dollar from 2019, if you just kept cash. And that's just going to kill you. So either you've got to spend your money right now, or you find something to protect yourself. And gold is one of the things that's working for now. And adding on what Joseph said, I had silver and I had a big position. We doubled our money on it. It's too speculative. And so we rotated all that position into gold. And I'm happy buying more at $5,500.
I think it's important to, everybody's talking about gold now. Of course it is. You're the triple and everybody's talking about precious metals. But the key story in debasement is that you have anything that has fundamental value, anything that you can consider a hard asset, particularly anything that could be perceived as a strategic asset in a world of multiple entities bidding for what has limited supply. At some point, those things, it's not a matter of global supply. It's a matter of who can access what supply. And so similar to what happened with the OPEC crisis, commodities writ large, industrial commodities, particularly things that are strategic, that are in a world of a multipolar world with geopolitical conflicts, strategic assets are the game. And you can think of gold as that hard asset, that debasement trade. It's the classical one that is one. But I think the key is not to get so focused on gold and the currency dynamics to miss the debasement realities and, you know, agriculture, farmland. I think there's an incredible opportunity in things that are forgotten and not thought about, like Alcoa and aluminum, given power inputs. And of course, the one that's been left for dead, energy. I think energy is the last one to move. When it moves, it will be the last way out. The tip of the spear has moved, but the rest is kind of following behind it. And I think the key is to approach that in a very diversified way. You can rotate through them as opportunities present themselves on a multi-year basis. But I think to just look at gold and precious metals is missing a lot of other opportunities that might be much better.
Fair enough. Thank you.
I'll just add that we just had the FOMC. What's standing out is that we had two dissents this time. We expect Governor Myron to dissent, but we also see Waller also dissented as well. Again, Waller, as we know, is one of the candidates for Fed chair. One difference is that Myron is dissenting and he would just like to have 25 basis points instead of his usual 50 basis points. So I think Waller's dissent is a surprise.
Looks like in the short term, at least, markets might agree with that. Pretty hefty move initially on the NQ, for example, up to almost 26,200 and right back down to almost 100. A little bit of a wiggle going on. What else are we seeing, folks?
Well, I think the statement had to be changed. I think that the statement says unemployment rate has shown some signs of stabilizing. The previous statement really said, it said the unemployment rate has edged up through September. This was the December statement. Downside risks to employment rose in recent months. Economic activity has been expanding at a moderate pace. I haven't seen the latest statement, but obviously those things needed to be modified because economic activity has been expanding at a fairly robust pace. I am surprised that Waller did dissent in favor of a cut. I thought he had more integrity, but clearly he wants the Fed chair job. He wants to keep himself in contention, and I suppose that's the only way. I'm not sure what else there is that's much of a surprise. I mean, you know, Treasury volatility is just on the floor, and there's been virtually no reaction in the Treasury market to this. I mean, Treasury futures have ticked down a 30-second. It seems to me like there's very little market reaction to this. It was all very much expected. There'd be no change in rates. I suppose the big surprise is that Moran only dissented in favor of 25 rather than 50, as Joseph said. And for me, I'm surprised that Waller dissented in favor of 25.
All right, last bear, Martin or Jem, anything you want to add so far about the drop or the dot plots before I start hammering some more topics home?
Yeah, I just want to make sure people aren't just focused on the traditional story of what did the Fed do and what are the dot plots, but be prepared that not only is what Powell's going to say here important, it's important about what's the likely announcement coming from the administration on who the Fed chair is. That's probably coming in the next 48 hours. And then what is that person likely to project? So that's probably coming. So don't just think about what's said here. It's what's the contrary argument going to be based on what's said here and how is that perceived. So I think there's a bit of, I understand there's multiple Fed meetings happening in the next 48 hours, not just.
Yeah, the other element to add, I would say, is like obviously the subpoena of Powell seemed to cross a pretty big red line, and I think it'll be interesting to see if Powell addresses those issues. I think obviously the politicization of the Fed has been a topic since Trump's been in office, but I think that he probably did overstep and recognizes that he did probably on some bad advice from certain members of his circle that got walked back pretty fast. But it'll be interesting to see if that more aggressive tactic ends up backfiring and sort of creates a more resolute Fed as a result. And interesting to see if Powell talks about it today.
I took a look at compared to last month. It looks like they softened more of the with more of a hawkish tilt on the employment side. Job gains have slowed, and last month and employment has edged up. Now it's saying job gains have remained low and showing signs of stabilization. Also, I was looking for to see if there was anything in regards to changes to reserves or balance sheet, because last time they had mentioned the initiation of purchase of shorter term treasury. So there's nothing further there that that stands out.
All right.
I think one thing to look for today is if we have any more information about whether or not Chirpal will step down after his chairmanship ends in May. Because otherwise he could stay there. You could actually have a shadow Fed chair there, but not the kind the administration wants. So if he offers any insight on his plans, and you can't really remove a Fed governor unless for cause, and that's not defined. And we're going through this litigation to see whether or not Governor Cook can be removed. But an open question is, let's say that if for whatever reason Powell does get criminally indicted, is that for cause, right? That kind of creates a pretext that some ambiguity, some space to try to have more influence as to who can have that seat later on.
Yeah, and importantly, to follow up on that, on what Joseph said, that Cook decision by the Supreme Court is probably the most important thing that's going to be decided in the next year, period. I mean, point blank, by far the most important thing. If the administration is able to coerce and come to its outcomes, have leverage over Fed members, which is what that decision is basically going to allow or disallow, their power increases. And by the way, I think, the biggest decision probably by this administration about who they make Fed chair is who they can most control, who they can most depend on, you could say it that way, to carry out their policy decisions, not the independent Fed decision, but their policy choices, and how much power can they commandeer from the Federal Reserve. And so that influence and how much control they have is going to be essentially decided by that Cook Supreme Court decision. And so by extension, the independence of the Fed is at stake in that decision. And so by far, the most important thing, the Fed is the most powerful entity in the world, I would argue. People might disagree with me as it stands. But if again, that power is then commandeered by the executive branch, we live in a very, very different world. The moment that happens.
So I'm going to pivot a little bit here, and I want to go back to something that was said earlier regarding spending. Martin, just a few hours ago, actually this morning, you posted, quote, "With all the money printing since the GFC in 2008 and its ramp up to support continued massive deficit spending post 2020, the move in the S&P 500 has been an illusion in real terms." And Martin, to be frank, kind of putting on blast my brain here a little bit, I'm going to need an explain like I'm five on that one. Can you help me out?
So all I did was, and I talked about it earlier, I posted a chart showing what the market was priced in gold. Gold, it has a limited supply, and you just can't print it. Not yet anyway. And so, we're all looking at these things. We're all saying, okay, my house is up here, my stocks are up here, everything's great. But let's look at what you're getting bang for your buck. And this is why the debt market is so, and this is why we need low interest rates. And let's take a step back. Back in the 80s, when mortgage rates were 13, 14%, you were better off than you are now. Because you could buy a house for 1.5 times your income with a 13% mortgage, and as a percentage of your disposable income, you're further ahead. Today, you got to take on 15 times your income in some cities, and the rates are doesn't work at 5 or 6%, and so you're better off with less leverage, and that's simply because of the value, the appreciation of the purchasing power of your dollar. This reminds me a lot of when I worked in capital markets. I spent 10 years in investment banking as a research analyst. And we did an IPO of our boutique firm. And of course, as a young whippersnapper, I didn't get a lot of equity. And then when the share price rocketed from $5 to $25, all the insiders wanted to get out. And then they went to me and said, hey, young whippersnapper, you just be a team player. Let's sell you our stock in a secondary at $24 and we'll give you a multi-million dollar loan to do so by one of the Canadian banks. And I said, well, that's fine and dandy, but give me a put protection on that. And they said, you're not a team player. Well, thank God I didn't do that because the value of that stock went from 24 back down to 2 and I would have been wiped out financially. And we are in a situation today where we're trying to provide leverage so people can offload their assets, or an aging baby boomer at 71 years old owns a pile of stocks and houses, and they have to find a buyer for it. And there isn't without leverage. And that's what I'm saying, is that the value of what you own is important. Now, that one chart, it's you're much better off being invested in the market, absolutely, than sitting in cash. And there's a lot of people sitting in cash and they're going to get killed. So it's just a matter of recognizing what the long-term trend is and zooming out, because debasement is separate from inflation, and it's something that we need to be cognizant of.
Thank you, Martin. So I just a little bit on GDP again. Economic growth, I mean, it's remained positive entering 2026. Joseph had that comment earlier in referencing Johnny about the GDP going through 2025 into 2026. But it's argued that a lot of that resilience has been driven by consumer spending rather than, you know, business investment. And it's also been shown that I think something like the top 10% of earners, again, to that discrepancies we discussed earlier, are who make up something insane, like 90% of the spending. Paraphrasing, so don't quote me on that. But how is that really sustainable? How sustainable is a growth mix that relies so heavily on consumption, even as households face tighter credit conditions, slower income growth, and frankly, the ability to find a job, really? Joseph, could you start us off on that? And then
jump in quickly. I have to jump for another meeting. I just wanted to say thank you, everyone, so much. And thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure this time. Thank you very much, guys.
Hey, always a pleasure to have you on, Martin. Thanks for coming while you could.
You know, I think that goes back to Martin's illustration, in that I think you just have a generation of people who are really asset rich and they are selling it and using that to finance their consumption. Actually, Martin's story reminds me of what I saw when I went to try to sell my silver, right? There's a long line of people to sell silver, all of them boomers. And there's only one person in line to buy silver, and that was a Zoomer. And, you know, we'll see how that turns out. But I think there is this kind of this just, you have a lot of people who've just accumulated a lot of assets and are be able to finance their consumption from that.
And so just kind of to further a bit of my curiosity there, is that concerning at all? Is that, you know, demonstrative of something that's not necessarily being tracked as much in terms of growth?
Well, can I just jump in and make a couple of points here?
Yeah.
First of all, the fact that the savings rate did fall recently in the most recent income and spending data that we had, that is part largely because total income growth has slowed, because total employment growth has slowed to, I think it was just 0.37% year on year. That's the number of jobs that there are in the economy. The job growth over the year slowed to 0.37%. Now, productivity gains lifted GDP. That's kind of the wrong way to look at it. We typically, you look at GDP and you look at the number of hours worked and you back out a productivity number. But there's something inconsistent about an economy that's been growing at something like 3% a quarter for the last three quarters. I mean, the Atlanta Fed is estimating over 5% for Q4. It's probably going to come in at closer to, well, 3, maybe 4 max. But so let's call it 3% per quarter for the last three quarters, and yet job growth has slowed to a virtual standstill. I doubt very much that there has been such a productivity miracle that we've, you know, that the US has been able to achieve that kind of output with so few additional employees. And I think what's happened is, we've already discussed, there's a very, very low level of layoffs currently. You know, it's close to a half century low. But firms have slowed down their hiring decisions. And I think what happened during last year, we had the uncertainty from the tariffs, we had the uncertainty from the government shutdown, and now we have Trump's chaotic policy making, which is adding a new layer of uncertainty. But I think at some point, companies can only delay the hiring decision for so long. At some point, they are going to have to start hiring again to manage the demand that's in the economy. Domestic demand has been very, very strong over these last three quarters. So I think at that point, as we see stronger growth in employment, we will see stronger growth in total income, and income and spending will be in better balance. The savings rate will move higher again. So I think this idea that consumers are just sort of running down their savings and or you know, maxing out the credit cards, I'm not sure that's quite true. I do expect things to normalize. As far as the economy is concerned, consumption is 70% of GDP. So you can't get away from it. We are a consumer-driven society, and that's how modern societies are. So you've got to keep the consumer happy. You've got to keep them spending.
Fair enough. Thank you. One topic we didn't deep dive, but we just kind of tickled the surface of, we've got about 11 minutes now before Jerome Powell takes the podium. So just kind of like quick tidbits here on the bond market, on yield curve. So Treasury yields have kind of remained elevated relative to pre-pandemic norms, even as inflation has cooled a little, and it's kind of keeping attention focused on the shape of that yield curve. And so just kind of a generalized to the panel at large, what really is your take on long-term yields at this stage as a signal about inflation risk, fiscal supply, or, you know, structurally higher neutral rate? Let's start with Last Bear, and I'd like to kick this one around.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's still plenty of room for sort of, you know, spreads to increase to sort of more historical norms that would sort of, you know, be a combination of the short end coming down by some degree and, you know, the long end either staying flat or even increasing. I think that we're still at a very flat curve relative to sort of the normal circumstance. Part of that, I think, is driven by the forward guidance of the Fed that didn't used to be a case prior to 2012 and really might change the way in which sort of the yield curve is shaped going forward. But yeah, I mean, I think that like, there's on the long end, there's sort of the big existential questions about federal spending, the strength of the dollar over the long term, the, you know, the countries being less and less comfortable with holding reserves and U.S. treasuries as opposed to other assets or hard assets. And I think that those are sort of like big long term trends. And then at the short end, you know, people kind of are willing to look past those things because even if you have sort of a multi-decade debt spiral, let's say, you know, that's probably actually not going to necessarily impact what happens next month or next year. And so I do think that there's sort of this, we're holding these two sort of really, really different concepts simultaneously in our head, which is what is, you know, does it make sense to hold a government treasury for 30 years at a 4.5% rate, you know, given where we know sort of the broad secular sort of really unstoppable trends are in terms of spending and demographics and healthcare and social security and all, everything else, versus practically where's the Fed, you know, rate going to be? Where can I get a little bit of spread? What's the best place to sort of optimize on whatever sort of quote unquote cash position that you have in the near term? So I think it's, there's, you know, personally, I think that there's plenty of room on the long end to continue to increase, especially to the extent that the short end might be sort of nearing the bottom for this cycle, absent some sort of, you know, depression or recession or something like that. So I think that those, you're going to see increasingly two different schools of thought playing out on different ends of the curve.
Thank you, Les Baer. To kind of continue this vein of thought, when backward-looking GDP data conflicts with softer forward-looking indicators, which should policymakers, and by extension even investors, which should they place greater weight on at this stage of the cycle? Johnny, do you want to go ahead with that one?
Yeah, I think the there's been a bit of a disconnect between these forward-looking indicators and what the resulting economic data have subsequently shown. I think the relationship between many of them broke down after the pandemic. Certainly we see that in some of the PMIs in Europe. In the US, if we look at the consumer sentiment surveys, I mean, the University of Michigan survey, they changed the methodology. So rather than house to house conducting the surveys, you know, in person, it's now done online, I believe. And I think people are much more willing to give a very negative view of the economy online rather than face to face. So there was that kind of disconnect about a year or so ago. But, you know, all these, if you try to find some sort of match between what the consumer sentiment surveys say and what consumers actually subsequently do in terms of spending, the relationship is really, really not very good at all. So I think you've got to be very careful in reading too much into those types of surveys. And the same thing, in fact, with the PMIs. I put a chart out on my Twitter space the other day about how the ISM manufacturing index has really, really understated the growth in manufacturing output in the US. Manufacturing output has grown something like 2% year on year for the last 3 or 4 months. And yet, if you look at the ISM manufacturing index, it's still below 50. So there has been this disconnect, and people are supposed to try and answer the survey questions objectively, but I just think they give a subjective assessment, and it's been far too downbeat recently.
And so kind of one more to that end, if growth, and again, I spent a lot of times asking questions that equate to superlatives and hypotheticals, but if growth slows toward trend without turning negative, would that be enough to justify further policy easing? Or again, in the traditional sense, notwithstanding the changing landscape with midterms coming up, does the Fed tend to view that outcome as evidence that the current stance is working? Let's go Joseph on that one.
So I think it's important to remember that the Fed's mandate is price stability and full employment. Growth is not in it. Growth is often associated with employment and things like that. But what we've seen is strong growth, potentially through productivity, probably overstated, and a weak labor market so far. That looks like it's been improving. Now, in thinking about the Fed, I personally think that the Fed's reaction function is going to be different. And when we have a new Fed, new composition of the Fed, I do think it's going to be more under the influence of the executive. Now, I do understand that we do have the Fed presidents that rotated on the FOMC are more hawkish. But, you know, you have a president that's been squeezing Fed governors, squeezing the Fed chair himself. And in the political totem pole in the U.S., a Fed president is very, very low. It's like a employee of a private sector nonprofit, actually. So I think we're heading into this new phase where we're going to have more of a populist regime, like Jim mentioned, and that is going to entail a more politically influenced Fed. One of the candidates, one of four Fed chair, Rick Reeder, he's actually kind of a kind of on board with that. If you listen to what he says, he's like, you know, the Fed, you know, interest rates not super effective on managing the economy. You're going to have to partner with fiscal authorities and so forth. Even making some MMT-like analysis saying that, hey, when we have really high interest rates, you know, sometimes it doesn't really work that well because you increase the interest income of people who have a lot of cash or fixed income. So it's a different way of looking at how the economy works. So I think it's very difficult for the market to price that in going forward and looking what rates would be. I think it's going to be more about listening to what the political leaders would like it to be. And they definitely have the tools to really set the curve to whatever they want it to be.
Beautifully said, Joseph. Thank you. We've got about 3 minutes before Jerome Powell takes the podium and gives us some beautiful words to coincide with the data drop from half an hour ago. I just want to real quick, each of you, where can people find you? What's something that you're working on? And kind of send these folks into the Jerome Powell presser with some bright eyes and bushy tails to learn more. Let's start off with Joseph and just work our way right down the line.
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me. You guys should definitely follow everyone here. I've learned a lot from all of them. If you're interested in learning more about what I do, I have a YouTube channel. It's called Joseph Wang. And after the FOMC, I will post a debrief as to what I thought happened and, you know, just highlight some points of the FOMC meeting press conference.
Thank you, Joseph. Definitely check that out, folks. I learn a lot of stuff when I pop into those little releases he does. They're not super long. They're really concise, and you're going to learn a ton from them, 10, 20 minutes. Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my highlights every 6 weeks is getting on board with all these brilliant guys and getting to kind of pontificate on the world. We've gotten a lot of it right over the many years and kind of, again, still sharpened steel, I think is, I think it's been wonderful. So thanks for including me. But if anybody wants to reach out, highvolatility.com, you can do highvolatility.com/news. If you want to get on our distribution list and see what we're talking about every week, highwealth.com. If we can help with broad non-correlated wealth advisory, focusing on risk adjusted return in this increasingly difficult 60-40 world. But yeah, thanks for including me. Good luck out there.
Thanks as always for coming, Jim. Last Bear, where can people find you? What you're working on?
Yeah, you can check me out here on Twitter. Also find a link to my Substack and in the bio. I also launched a portfolio on a new platform called Plutus that people can find through my links as well, with some small cap contrarian type plays that I like that you might find interesting. The only other thing I'd mention that I don't know that we touched on in the conversation that I think is relevant for the year ahead is midterms. I think that every lever that can be pulled by the executive branch in a positive growth fashion is going to be pulled. We've already seen a lot of those type of announcements come through, and I think that's only going to increase going forward, and that'll be a factor to watch going forward. So thanks again for having me, and talk at next FOMP.
Thanks as always for coming, Last Bear. Looking forward to it. And bringing up Anchor, Johnny. Where can people find you? What you working on?
Yep, certainly they can go to my website, super-macro.com. I publish, you can get a free subscription for 30 days. I publish a daily newsletter giving a run through the day's macroeconomic data and markets and the impact on the markets. And once a week, a more detailed look at markets and the impact of and policy announcements and economics. So just go to the website, super-macro.com, sign up for a free trial subscription for 30 days. And if you like it, you can run with it.